Hello, I'm Eric Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You're listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, "We Really Can Multitask, New Brain Study Finds," by Alan Woodward. Then Amira McKee has, "Protein Craze Has a Problem, Shortage of Whey." Letty Teague wrote, "We miss our friend, sharing his wines, we find him." And we'll follow that up with Elizabeth Swoboda's article, "I Take 24-Hour Micro Retreats, You Should Too." All these articles are from editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one. We really can multitask, new brain study finds. We've all been there, listening to a Zoom meeting while responding to a coworker's urgent email, and maybe trying to arrange the kids' after school schedule at the same time. Multitasking is the reality of modern life, yet scientists have long debated what is actually happening inside our brains. For years, they thought the brain could not truly do two things simultaneously. Instead, they believed multitasking was just our brain rapidly switching between tasks. Now, research suggests we really can do multiple things at once. After enough practice and experience, the brain can rewire its circuitry to support multitasking, according to a recent study in the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience. The brain can learn to automate certain tasks by offloading them from an area called the prefrontal cortex, a control center responsible for high-level thinking and decision-making that can focus on only one thing at a time, to other regions. This may explain why we can build some skills, like going from plucking single notes on a guitar to shredding rock riffs, or from dribbling a ball to making cross-country plays. In this study, participants, 11 women and men between the ages of 18 and 29, sorted computer-generated images of cars into categories while researchers scanned their brains. Then, participants practiced image sorting more than 30,000 times over 5 to 10 weeks using a smartphone app. Researchers scanned their brains again. The scientists found that, while first learning the task, the participants' prefrontal cortex was activated. After practice, the scan showed a different part of the brain got involved, an area called the temporal cortex, which deals with memory and recognizing objects. After the initial training, people were already good, sorting with at least about 90% accuracy, said Maximilian Reisenhuber, a professor of neuroscience at Georgetown University School of Medicine and co-author of the research. With repetition, they got faster until plateauing, which he thinks was when the sorting task became automated. The study makes it clear this automation does not come free, but rather with lots of repetition, according to Patrick Cox, an assistant professor of psychology at Lehigh University and another co-author. The brain is plastic and flexible. And if you can put the hours in, it really can take us effortful, hard things and make them easy and less attentionally demanding, Cox did say. And now, protein craze has a problem, shortage of whey. Food makers are cramming protein into everything from chips to bread and candy bars. Now, the industry's go-to additive is running dry. Whey protein concentrate, a powder that has long been used to fortify sports drinks and infant formulas, packs a high protein punch. Snack food companies are loading up on the ingredient to woo protein-obsessed consumers, including those taking weight loss drugs. But with protein cereal, ice cream, and popcorn, there isn't enough whey protein to go around. The price for whey protein concentrate 80, a highly popular additive that is 80% protein, surged to a high of more than $13 a pound in the United States, according to data from market insights firm Vesper. That is nearly three times its value a year earlier. Whey protein isolate, a more processed version that is higher in protein, has seen about a 50% boost in price, according to the data. We've never quite seen it like this, where it's climbing that aggressively without a line of sight, said Darren Bradshaw, head of operations at protein food company Legendary Foods in Santa Monica, California. To keep up with the rising cost, the maker of protein-packed baked goods soon expects to boost its prices for the second time in 2 years. Manufacturers of the ingredients say their suppliers are sold out, committed to long-time clients, or tied up in contracts through next year. If someone decides they don't want their load, you have five people that want to buy it, said Mike Brown, who heads market intelligence at dairy trading firm P.J. Jacoby & Company in St. Louis, Missouri. Whey is a byproduct of cheese making, left over after milk has curdled. The raw milk eclair liquid was worthless until a few decades ago. Cheesemakers would sometimes pay farmers to dump the whey onto their fields or feed it to livestock, said Corey Geiger, lead dairy economist at CoBank. Now, I can assure you that there is not one droplet of whey in this country that is left behind, said Marina Crocker, senior director of product category and marketing at Hillmar, a major producer of cheese and whey proteins in Hillmar, California. Turning liquid whey into premium protein concentrates and isolates takes multi-million dollar ultrafiltration systems and drying towers. The manufacturing process created a bottleneck in supply, said dairy economist Leonard Polson at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Cheese producers are racing to build out their capacity to process these high-protein whey ingredients. Friesland Campina, a Dutch multinational dairy company and cooperative, acquired ingredient processor Wisconsin Whey Protein this year. Other players in the industry poured capital into new whey processing machinery and infrastructure to boost output. United States dairy processors have invested $11 billion in new capacity, technology, and supply chain improvements through 2028 to meet consumer demand for dairy-based protein, according to the International Dairy Foods Association. But it could take several years before the machinery comes online and a new wave of whey protein hits the market, said Goose Aerts, managing director of Friedland Campina's ingredients business. The consumer demand is simply outpacing that increase in capacity, he said. For the next couple of years, there will be unserviced consumer demand. Scaling up production across the sector requires more cheese to be made. But Americans are gunning for more protein, not necessarily more cheese. So some producers are making more cheese for its byproduct, whey, even if that means selling the leftover curds into a weaker market. Luke Cotty, a senior culinary scientist at food innovation firm Matson, said he often steers companies seeking help developing new products away from whey protein and towards cheaper and more plentiful options such as milk protein isolate, a dairy-derived ingredient that requires less processing. But lately, the prices of those ingredients have started creeping up too, he said. Now, we miss our friend. Sharing his wines, we find him. When my friend Jeff Joseph died, he left behind many warm memories and over 1,000 bottles of wine. Never mind that Jeff, whom I've written about in the column beforehand, had sold thousands of bottles from his collection over the years, including hundreds of blue chip Burgundies back in a 2011 auction. He kept buying wines, and now his wife, Pat Jones, had to figure out what to do with all the bottles he left behind. She asked Tim Kopeck, a fine wine consultant friend, to inventory and value the wines for estate planning and sale. But another friend, John Magazzino, suggested Pat might sell some wines first to a small group of friends. That group included my husband and me. Kopeck fully endorsed the idea. I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to have some bottles that he carefully selected spread among his friends? It took Kopeck several days to catalog and price all the wines in the special temperature-controlled room Jeff created in his and Pat's apartment, as well as wines stored off-site. In a way, it was remembering the history of my relationship with Jeff. The cellar touched all those years, Kopeck said. Among the great bottles of Burgundy and Barolo, Kopeck also discovered wines from the Canary Islands, moderately priced Albarinos, and even a few Argentine Malbecs. I was surprised to hear there were so many relatively simple wines. What was Jeff, the discerning collector, doing with such bottles? Jeff was as interested in learning as he was in collecting, Kopeck replied. When Kopeck finished noting and pricing the wine, Pat selected just 100 to keep herself. I'm not a collector, she explained. She thought it made more sense to share them, as Magazzino had suggested. Pat emailed Kopeck's spreadsheet, aka the Jeff list, to a small group of friends and arranged for the bottles to be sent to a storage facility in Westchester County, New York, for safekeeping. Seeing the room emptied of Jeff bottles was one of the hardest moments, Pat recalled. It was also very different. But she found consolation in knowing Jeff's carefully curated wines would be enjoyed by his friends. When my husband, Roger, and I received the Jeff list, several other friends had already chosen which to buy. Kopeck had purchased a lot of great wines, like the 2008 Dom Perignon Champagne, the 2008 Paul Roger Cuvée Sir Winston Churchill Champagne, and the 1985 Jean-Louis Chef Hermitage, Jeff's friend Doug Polander, owner of wine import company Douglas Polander Selections in Mount Kisco, New York, bought bottles of Bruno, Gassiola, Barbaresco, and several Domaine Joseph Johine wines. The latter did hold special meaning for Jeff, a fan of the wines, as well as a good friend of Laurent Johine, whose family owns the Domaine. For his part, Magazzino deliberately sought out wines without labels. I knew the provenance was good, he explained, even if the producer or vintage was unknown. The prices were certainly right. Wines without labels have limited auction value. A bottle listed simply as 1997 Old Ravenau went for $120, a fraction of the price of a labeled wine from Domaine Ravenau, one of the priciest and most celebrated producers of Chablis. The wine was terrific, Magazzino said. Roger and I bought some white Burgundies, including the 2010 Domaine Joseph Johine Chasselet Montrenos Marquis de la Gouche Mogeno, what a name, for $120, and the 2008 Billy Cart Simon Cuvée Elizabeth Rosé Champagne, $160, and the bargain price magnums of the 2014 Costa Rivet Fleury Bujalos, $52, and the 2017 Edmond Cornu Les Versandes Corton Grand Cru, $100. We opened the champagne and the champagne Majorac within 2 weeks, and both were fantastic. Thanks, Jeff. The Drouhin was a particular delight. When I mentioned this to winemaker Perrin Drouhin, she said, "People seeking a great white who cannot afford Montchimay will always have incredible pleasure with this premier cru." She was right about both our inability to afford Montcharette and the pleasure the more gold delivered. I look forward to opening one bottle in particular, the 1995 Andrew Will Winery Sorella, $40, a Bordeaux-style blend from Washington State, the wine that could easily have ended my friendship with Jeff. It was back in 2008, the year billionaire Bill Koch filed lawsuits against multiple wine auction houses, alleging that they'd sold him hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of fake wine. Given how easy it was to fool such a sophisticated collector, I decided to try making a fake of my own, and not just any old wine, but a fake 1982 Chateau Mouton Rothschild, the famed 100-point first growth Bordeaux. My co-conspirator in the stunt, which I wrote about back then in my column for Food and Wine magazine, was Chris Camarda, founder and winemaker at Andrew Will Winery. He possessed both the winemaking skill and an appetite for devilry. We tasted the real Mouton, which I purchased and brought to his winery on Vashon Island, Washington. Then we experimented with blending a few wines before deciding his 1995 Sorella was close in character to the Mouton. So Camarda poured the Sorella into the Mouton bottle and recorked it for me to take home. I flew back to New York with the fake Mouton and invited several friends, wine professionals, and passionate amateurs to a special Mouton dinner. They showed up with great wines of their own. Jeff brought a bottle of the 1990 Trimbach Clos St. Hunay Riesling from Alsace and the 1989 Chateau Clonette, another 100-point Bordeaux. When the dinner was over and I revealed the identity of my Mouton, some friends laughed, a couple were mad, but Jeff wasn't bothered. He said it was still his wine of the night. He also said, "Don't ever do that again." Holding that bottle of 1995 Andrew Will Sorellas all these years later, I was thrilled that Jeff had actually been impressed enough with the wine to buy a bottle for himself. Of course, the wine was now 3 decades old. The odds were long that it would be as good as when we had tasted it together. My husband and I opened the bottle at dinner at a BYO restaurant with our friend Bert, who knew Jeff too. I wish I could report that the 1995 Andrew Will Winery Sorella had the same beguiling character that had impressed Jeff so long ago. Alas, it was but a shallow dough of its former self. I was disappointed, but only briefly. The magic of the memory that it brought, of Jeff the collector who was open to all wine as long as it was good. Besides, I thought along a second wine. As Jeff had taught me, you always need to have a backup bottle on hand. And now, I take 24-hour micro retreats. You should too. As I emerge from my children's earliest years, a miasma of Duplo blocks, nursing pads, and sleepless nights, I felt utterly depleted, not just in a physical sense, but also in a creative one. Gone were the days I'd spent head down in essays or book projects. I was lucky if I got 20 minutes to focus before the next high-pitched interruption. So I decided to take a cue from the writer Joyce Maynard, who sometimes holes up in motels to write. In chats with my husband, I floated the idea of a micro-retreat, checking into a room after noon, then returning around the same time the next day. These micro-retreats have proven so engaging that I now take a few each year, and science suggests such hiatuses, despite their brief duration, enthusiasm, and relieve mental exhaustion in potent ways. They're a welcome temporary escape from a chaotic world. During my retreat, I use travel points to book a hotel in or near my hometown. I favor those that let me check in early. Somehow, just entering the room and sitting at the desk seems to prime my mind for this kind of deep dives. I reach a point of no return by late afternoon, when I stop to relax over dinner, then write or brainstorm for a couple more hours. The next morning, I dive into one final writing session before heading home. One reason micro retreats suit me so well is that they usher me into a flow state deeper than anything I can achieve in everyday life. On normal days, most of us do a lot of what's called context switching, toggling from one unrelated task to another, answering emails, leading meetings, etc. Studies show that not only do we lose time amidst this constant task switching, our cognitive reserves get depleted. 43% of workers report that context switching is mentally exhausting. For me, micro retreats eliminate about 90% of this juggling. Clearing away background static allows me to plunge into extended mental flow as I write, a state that researchers report is simultaneously absorbing and rewarding. And because flow activities brain networks that consume low amounts of energy, we experience it as a fun, playful state rather than a draining one. I am not the only one who craves this state. The engineer Randall Tinsel prizes what he calls his creative cloister time so highly that his wife once asked him, "If you have to give up either sex or your cloister time, what would you choose?" When Tinfeld found himself at a loss for words, she grinned, "Yep, I figured that." Another benefit of micro-retreats is that they remove you from your usual environment, a shift that research shows distances you from daily worries. In one study, people who traveled on a short weekend break ruminated less about work concerns than people who spent a similar break at home. The travelers also spent less time on domestic chores, which no doubt helped them recharge. The wonderful thing about the uncluttered time that micro retreats offer is that you can devote it to whatever you crave most. If you need a deep stretch of silence or reflection, design a micro retreat around that. Likewise, if you long to dive into a creative project, or like me, you could alternate between reflection and creation, with the first fueling the second. Of course, if you can swing them, longer breaks do offer deep restorative benefits. Vacationers in a European study reported the highest levels of health and well-being on the eighth day of their breaks, meaning complete unwinding may take a while to happen. Once my kids leave home in a few years, I may be able to take extended breaks more often. But until then, I do cherish my cloister time by the spoonful. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.